Hello, and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 9 for Monday, July 12th, 2010. Another great show for you this evening. Unlike last week, there are more people than just me in the studio. We got Ryan Lancey back again.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
And for the first time, we have Jeff Betts.
Hey, how's everybody doing out there?
All right. So let's jump right into it. So, got a couple articles that I just thought were kind of cool. This first one is a little creepy. So, the New York Times reports that the University of Central Florida is becoming like a casino. Have either of you guys heard about this recently? About colleges doing this type of thing where they're trying to crack down on cheaters?
Yeah, they got the eye in the sky.
This is ridiculous. So if you've seen on the New York Times page, it looks kind of like the control room in one of the Ocean's 11 movies with this guy looking over all of the video streams. And for all of the students who take tests in a computer lab, the monitors are recessed into the desks so they can tell, you know, where you're looking and that you're looking at the monitor. They have cameras that zoom in on you if the teacher thinks that you're cheating. And when the teacher thinks that you're cheating, the computer automatically starts recording what you're doing on the computer and the video feed from the camera of you so that they can make sure that students aren't cheating or use that as evidence if they think that they are. Personally, I think this is, I don't want to say ridiculous, but I mean, I teach at two colleges and cheating's not a problem for me. What do you guys think, whenever you were in school, was cheating a big problem, big enough to do something like this?
I know some of the stuff I was reading in the article, that they were basically like chastising people for working together. I know, like, we got a physics group together and we would all work on the questions together. You'd basically figure out the equation that you needed. From that equation, everybody would do it. So you'd click the next one, done. But is that really cheating or is that working together?
Yeah, I mean, the article didn't really say, at least I didn't catch it, what type of class this was, whether it was a like an engineering or computer science class or whether it was a poli-sci class that they just happened to be taking tests on the computers. Because in, you know, computer science or engineering classes, like you said, you work together. That's how you do things. So, I mean, what about you, Ryan? Did you see any cheating whenever you were in college?
You know, I remember one class we had that the professor was pretty lax about basically any type of classroom control, which is surprising for a university. I won't mention any names. But the teacher would – he basically told everyone that they could bring whatever they wanted into the exam. And a lot of people brought in – they brought in their calc books. They brought in their notes. You know, we were allowed to bring whatever. But there were certain people that had access to copies of older tests, and some of those tests were completely filled out. And this teacher was known to only cycle the tests once every 2 to 3 years, and it led to what I think is a lot of, you know, cheating. I guess if the teacher says you can bring whatever you want in, you know, you can bring whatever you want, but holding on to those old tests is I guess a form of cheating, or at least, I don't know, some kind of dishonesty.
Yeah, I mean, at least on my tests, like a lot of the tests that I give are open book, open note, open internet.
Easy.
Well, they're like that because they're rather difficult. You know, I give them problems that they have to look stuff up to figure it out. It's not something you can just memorize from the book and do it. You know, it's like a programming problem or something.
Yeah.
Not going to be in the book. You have to Google and figure out what you're doing. So, you know.
But you're treating it like it's the real world, too.
These exactly.
People are not going to do this in the real world. They're going to look things up before they try to accomplish something in the real world.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's a classic problem in education about being subjective or objective in your grading and your evaluation. And it's tough to do well. I hesitate to say that this doesn't go on. I think cheating is – I think especially with, like, papers, you know. Authoring a paper can be a time-consuming process. People don't want to put in the time. They're using these online services to get papers.
And that's exactly what this article, you know, starts comparing this to, the service Turnitin, where teachers can turn in or upload papers, and it will sift through them, you know, Google Index style, and try to figure out if anything is plagiarized, if they can find anything else on the internet from your paper.
So, yeah, I was surprised at some of the attacks that, or not attacks, means to circumvent the, you know, algorithms they were using. Like, they were replacing the letter E with, like, the Cyrillic version of the letter E, so that, like,
different ASCII code.
Yeah, for a computer, it's really easy to fool. You know, like, you visually wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Like, even like a U with like an umlaut over top of it, a reader might just glance over it because it looks like a U. You know, you'd be like, might think it's weird. Hey, there's an umlaut there, but a computer would be like totally unaware of like what it would have to have some other fuzzy logic to say, oh, if the person's replacing this specific ASCII character code with another ASCII character code, that it, they may be trying to fool me.
Right, it would have to have a leet speak dictionary.
It would, yeah, actually. Yeah. I'm like not too terribly worried about this because it's the University of Central Florida, and everyone knows that's not a real school.
Ouch. Yeah, so I hope this doesn't come anywhere around here. I mean, like I said, I don't see cheating as that big a deal, but apparently UCF does, that they were installing a casino-style monitoring system. It's kind of weird. So moving right along, the next story is something that pretty much, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say every mobile phone user has been dying to have in the past ever since you could have a phone connected to a computer. And that is Bluetooth 4.0, the spec for Bluetooth 4.0 being adopted, and now it's out for testing. Now, why is that a big deal? Well, a lot of people use Bluetooth to connect their phones to other things, to stream music, connect it to your car, connect it to your computer, connect phone to phone to transfer pictures or files between friends. But the cool thing with Bluetooth 4, excuse me, had to burp there, is the power consumption. So normal phones with Bluetooth, the entire logic board of the phone, the processor, the entire being of the phone has to deal with Bluetooth and the power consumption. So whenever you have Bluetooth on, you probably know that your battery dies rather quickly. With Bluetooth 4, there is an additional small logic board that they put in there to take control of Bluetooth and the power via Bluetooth. And they were able to get it down so far that it pretty much won't affect your phone at all. You know, they're saying that the Bluetooth 4.0 spec can let devices run on coin cell batteries for years. That was in quotes, 4 years. Not the number four. For a number of years.
For an epic.
Yes. So I think this is awesome. I can't wait until phones... I mean, it's probably a long way down the line that phones start implementing this, but just for power consumption alone, I would love to be able to have Bluetooth on and not have to charge my phone every day. Do either of you guys use Bluetooth enough that it matters?
I use it a good bit now that I have a car that has the Bluetooth wireless support, but the power part of it doesn't really seem to affect me too much. I mean, I know a friend of mine just got a Droid, and he said that when after he turned, there's a meter somehow built into it, tells you like what parts of the phone use the power, and Bluetooth was in like the maybe 10 to 15% range of the total power consumption of the device. So obviously, hey, I'd take 15% more battery life. But as of right now, it's not really affecting me. You know, I think I get enough battery life out of my phone.
Do you leave Bluetooth on all the time, or do you only turn it on when you get in your car?
No, I leave it on. Yeah, the first... I have a BlackBerry. The first OS that it came with, it was terrible. If you left it on, it just sucked the battery dry. But they released a few updates, and BlackBerry OS 5.0 has been really good with that. So
that's good to know. I'm going to go get my blue snarfing gun and steal all your data via Bluetooth.
Oh, okay.
What about you, Jeff?
It's unsecure. It's power hungry. I just never got into Bluetooth for those reasons. It was just – it always seemed like a bad idea. You know, why put your phone to where it's going to – oh, I've got no battery now, and everybody's got my data. This is great.
Yeah, I'm kind of along that same side. I really only use my Bluetooth connection whenever I have my Bluetooth earpiece in, which is very rare. I only use that whenever I know I'm going to be talking to somebody for a long amount of time, so I don't, you know, have my shoulder up. I know you guys listening can't see me making the motion with my shoulder, but you know what it is.
Hilarious.
Yeah, it was great. If you've ever tried to hold your cell phone with your shoulder up against your ear, you know that feeling. It's horrible. So that's really the only time I ever use Bluetooth. Any other time, since I have an iPhone, the Bluetooth is kind of locked down and I can't really do anything with it anyways. So I've never had the opportunity to use its coolness. I don't know. But another cool thing about it is right now, another downside of Bluetooth is that you can only get a connection within like 30 feet of whatever you're trying to connect to. And they're saying that with Bluetooth 4.0, it's beyond 200 feet. So that's quite amazing.
Kiss your data goodbye in the airport.
Seriously.
Yeah, see, there's some downsides to that. Like, one of the things that Bluetooth was always supposed to be was a replacement for the local wire connections in, you know, in your...
It's a PAN technology, personal area network.
Yeah, and, you know, we're really just talking about decluttering your desktop is what Bluetooth was originally designed to be. It wasn't like a wireless USB specification or anything. And I understand your concern about, you know, stealing data, but I think... You need some pretty sophisticated technology from a distance to steal your data. I mean, your device has to be discoverable to even know that it's there, really. I mean, unless you have some, like, really even more sophisticated stuff.
I mean, it does take a lot of things that need to fall in place for right. it to happen. But
yeah. But at 200 yeah. feet, it becomes probably less sophisticated because, like, with RF and anything else, especially RF, like, the sensitivity of your receiver has a lot to do with, like, the complexity of the equipment and the size of your antenna. And in the RF world, size matters. No, I'm just kidding. But the point is that, like, if the Bluetooth 4.0 spec allows, like, lower signal to or a lower signal noise ratio, which is the only way I could see them getting around the distance, if it's still a low power device, is that may allow people to steal things from a greater distance. That might be worse. I think Bluetooth works pretty well. If it was less power, or used less power, and it was more secure, I think everybody would, you know, be fine with it the way it is.
I agree. I wish those things would happen. And hopefully, with Bluetooth 4.0, they will. So early 2011 is when we can expect to see devices with Bluetooth 4.0. So I guess we got to wait a long time until then. So moving right along, this next thing is something that I actually saw from one of the hosts of another show that I watched called Techzilla. Patrick Norton was putting together a segment for Techzilla, and he was asking all of his Twitter followers, you know, what's your broadband speed? He wanted to do a segment on broadband. And this one person, I had a very mean name in mind, but you'll see why, from Chattanooga, replied and said, "Hey, yeah, we have fiber in Chattanooga, and I get 150 megabit download speed." Come on! I mean, really? Have either of you guys ever heard of anything this fast in the United States? Because I haven't.
Well, when you're in Chattanooga, you need 150 megabytes a second.
Seriously. I mean, what is in Chattanooga that they have this technology?
Oh, it's the Chattanooga choo-choo.
Oh, how could I not know this? I mean, really, there's got to be some politician or some, like, headquarters of some big company for them. Because no place else in the United States is there 150 megabit home internet connection. Like, even if you live in Pittsburgh or Baltimore and have Verizon's Fios, you're lucky if you're getting 30 to 50 megabits. Like, this is 150 megabits. So, yes, I'm mad at all of you people in Chattanooga for having a 150 megabit connection. But I'm also hopeful, because if places like Chattanooga can get this, that means that places like Johnstown can get this sometime within the next 30 years.
Yeah, I was just looking. The population of Chattanooga is about 170,000 people, so it puts it about two to three times the size of like the Johnstown metropolitan area.
Yeah, and not even close to what we would consider big cities. Like, you would expect something like this to be in New York City or San Francisco first. But here it is in Chattanooga. Yeah, I don't know. I think this is awesome. I think this is totally awesome, and I can't wait to get this type of connection at my home. Jeff, you look like you were going to say something.
It's going to start paving the way. If Chattanooga's got it, the next city's going to say, well, we want it too, and all you need is one.
That's right. Hopefully they started it.
Did they win the Google thing? Is that how they got it, maybe?
The article didn't mention. I mean, I've been looking at the article the whole time I was talking, and I see no mention of Google. So I really have no clue where this came from. Chattanooga's Municipal Electric Utility.
I think it's something like the Cambria Connected, where they just decided to do this.
Yeah, that would be awesome. All internet service providers need to just decide to do this.
Do you think they have the backhaul behind it, though, to support it widespread? I mean, you know, I'm not that everyone's going to use 150 megabits, but...
But I would.
Well, you try. I mean, even if you could use a lot of it, you wouldn't use it all the time. So I just wonder what they have in terms of, like, you know, what's coming into the city. Because, you know, like, I mean...
This may be a case of, like, normal internet connections today, you know, overselling.
Yeah.
You know, here we're giving you the capability of 150 megabits, but if you all try to use it...
Oh, here's why they have it. Samuel L. Jackson's from Chattanooga.
Oh!
He probably, like, kicks some ass to get it.
Hate that guy. So, Sam, if you're listening, move to Johnstown for, like, a year. Just long enough for us to get internet. That would be great. Thanks. Okay, so... Keeping in with the internet stories, for a while now, everybody who uses Twitter or has heard of Twitter has been wondering, you know, how are they making money? Twitter's a free service. You know, you just go on there, and most people make fun of it because they just think it's people saying, I went to this restaurant for lunch, or I just pooped. So I'm guilty of both. But everybody's been wondering how Twitter is going to be making money, because they have so many users, they have so many servers, so much, you know, internet bandwidth at their disposal. They're shelling out a lot of money. And their first attempt was at promoted tweets, which is basically if, you know, companies like Starbucks or any other companies that purchase advertising on Twitter tweet something, if somebody went to Twitter and started searching, that advertisement would pop up at the top of their search. So kind of like on Google, if you search for something, the first couple things that you see at the top of Google are the sponsored links. Twitter was doing the same thing. That really didn't seem to work out too well. So now they're starting with advertising accounts. Accounts that you can follow on Twitter, their only job is to spew out advertising. You know, sometimes coupon codes, sometimes special deals at restaurants. But the first one is Early Bird. So if you use Twitter and you follow Early Bird, you know, just like it sounds, all lowercase, no spaces or anything, Early Bird, you can find out, you know, I don't know. Have any of you followed this? Looked at the Early Bird account?
I haven't followed it, but I think it's the first promising thing that I've seen come from Twitter that may actually make them solvent. I don't like advertising unless it's good and it helps me. If it doesn't, then I'm not going to pay attention to it. It's either got to be funny or it's got to actually help me save money. And I think this is like a good idea. They put up the deals, you follow it. You know, the thing is, they could very easily overuse this stuff. Like if they put out little ads, you know, like every minute or something. And the same, you know, with anyone else using that sort of thing, it gets a little bit cumbersome and people will shut it off. So they have to, like, know their role, I think, in the Twitter community.
Yeah, what I don't want to see happen is this turn into, like, a lot of celebrities where when they get an account, they just start plugging their new movie, their new album, whatever, like, literally every 5 minutes. You go and check your Twitter feed and it's them every 5 minutes plugging something that you don't care about. So, yeah, I hope Early Bird doesn't do this.
I think they're going to overdo it. I think it's going to turn into exactly what Dig's turning into, where every third dig is something like, oh, the new HP laptop, I dig that, you know? And unfortunately, I think that's what's going to happen to Twitter, is they're going to get a taste of the money, and they're going to overdo it soon.
Well, the nice thing about Twitter is, though, is you pretty easily can, like, turn it off. Like, you can just not follow the thing anymore. So the people have a little bit of power in saying what.
I think they're going to interject it, though. Like, you'll go to Kevin's Twitter feed, and you'll see every fourth one is a GM ad or something like
that's
that.
That's what I'm worried about. Ryan, you're right now. You can just not follow Early Bird if you don't want that crap. But I'm worried, like, in my Twitter stream or in TweetDeck or third-party applications, they're just going to start injecting,
yeah,
you know, as time goes on.
Well, yeah, I guess it could get bad, but... I think it's just like TV ads. It's like I always say this. It's like, make them entertaining and I'll watch the damn things. They're rarely entertaining.
Yeah, some of them are.
Yeah, there's a few that are, and the rest are just really boring, and I don't want to watch them.
I'm on a horse.
That is a. Have you seen the behind the scenes video of how they made that commercial?
It is awesome.
It is awesome.
This is the Old Spice one?
Yes, the Old Spice commercial.
Yeah, that commercial's awesome.
And the new one where the dude is standing on, like, this river. He's on a log, like, standing in the river, rolling on a log, and then he, like, swan dives into a hot tub. They showed the behind the scenes on that, and it was all done in one shot. Amazing.
Yeah.
Like, this guy does clothes changes and everything in one shot. You don't even know what's happening. If you haven't seen the Old Spice ads, go look them up. They're on Old Spice's website.
Yeah, I don't know who markets them. Like, is it Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson?
I have no clue.
It's a little company.
Kudos. I switched from, what's the other deodorant, the other big brand?
Gillette?
No, deodorant.
Oh.
Is there another deodorant brand anymore?
I have no idea.
It might be the only one.
You wanted to smell like a man because you saw that dude.
Yeah, I switched.
I really want to be like him.
I was using Brute.
Oh, Brute.
Ooh.
That's actually a cologne.
Yeah. Isn't it Gillette? Doesn't Gillette make...
Maybe they do.
It starts with a G. It's a silver packaging. I just saw them advertise on TV like
that. I think
today.
It is Gillette.
I don't know. Whatever. Okay, so back for Twitter. Yeah, please don't screw this up. You know, if you're going to have accounts that advertise stuff, that is awesome. I will follow them just on the off chance that I can get coupon codes the same way that I follow Slick Deals in my Google Reader. You know,
Speed Stick. That's what I was thinking
Speed
of.
Speed Stick. Ah.
By Menon.
Costanza. All right, moving right along. So the next story is, we're back in Europe again. So if you remember a while back, we were talking about Germany being mad at Google for stealing Wi-Fi or data on Wi-Fi. And now Germany is not mad at Google, but, well, I'm sure they're still mad at Google. But now they're mad at somebody else. They are mad at Facebook. Why, you ask? Because they say that Facebook is stealing data of people who don't use Facebook. So without reading any more of the article, you know, just hearing my little caption of that, what do you guys think? Ridiculous, not ridiculous? Do you think it's even possible?
Well, I know they have that internet or that weird framework plugin that, like, if you're browsing outside of Facebook, it'll, like, be like, hey, like this on Facebook. And you're like, hey, how did you know that I'm this person? But it's really just using, like, your old cookies or whatever.
Right.
I don't know how they would steal other people's information.
Well, what they're claiming, have any of you, like, used the Find a Friend tool where it lets you import your Gmail address book and see if any of your Gmail contacts have Facebook accounts and link up?
Yeah.
So that's what they're claiming. They're claiming that Facebook, whenever they access your Windows Live or Gmail or Hotmail account or whatever, they're keeping all of that data that it finds, all the email addresses, all the people's names, and they are spamming those people more than just that initial email from your friend saying, hey, please come join Facebook.
Mm.
So that's what they're claiming. If this is true, I don't know. I've never had it happen. I've never heard of anybody complaining about it. If this is true, this is another blow to Facebook. Like, really, you're going to start spamming people now? People who don't even want to use Facebook?
Oh, wait. So Facebook is responsible for your friend's stupidity?
Yes.
They are?
Yes.
I say, if you get spammed from Facebook, just go beat up your friend.
Well, I agree with the first spam message. With that first, hey, come be my friend, please join Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
But after that, you know, that's what they're
then
saying.
Then beat up your friend.
Yeah.
It's telemarketing.
It's exactly what it is. It's
just an email address instead of a phone number.
Yep, it's internet telemarketing, and Facebook is doing it now. So says Germany.
Your friend gave away your number, you know?
Beat them up.
Okay, so you heard it here first, folks. If any of your friends use Facebook, beat them up. So moving on before I get beat up. Another Facebook problem, and this is actually a pretty big deal, maybe not so much to us, because of where we live, but to people along the Gulf Coast. There was a single fan page on Facebook for boycotting British Petroleum, BP, because of the crap about the oil spill. And that was pretty much immediately taken down. It had, what was it, over 800,000 fans, over 800,000 people liked the Boycott BP page on Facebook, and Facebook just got rid of it, deleted it, gone. immediately some of those people started making other Boycott BP pages and, you know, started getting more followers on those. But what do you guys think of this? Some people were speculating that Facebook has backing from BP, and they're like, oh, we can't have this. BP is giving us $20 billion. You know, other people are just wondering why.
There had to be some pressure from BP from someplace. I mean, why else would they take it down?
Yeah, I wonder what kind of pressure it was, though. Because the only kind of pressure there could be is they're giving money. Oh, peer pressure. Yeah.
Hey, everybody else is taking it down. Why don't you take it down, too?
We'll give you some money.
I mean, that has to be the case, right? What other type of pressure from an oil company could be put on an internet social networking site?
It could be indirect. There could be oil execs that invest in BP and also invest in Facebook.
Oh, the indirect. That's a bad one. So, yeah, this is. I think this is bad. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't have put it on here if it wasn't a bad thing for Facebook. But, yeah, this is just another blow. You know, Facebook doing something else that everybody sees as wrong. Whether it is or not, everybody sees it that way.
Yeah, I mean, they have the right to control what's on their network for the time being until the government steps in at some point, which they probably will. But until that happens, they have that right, I guess. And, I mean, if they want to, they're going to choose their bedfellows. There was actually a really interesting article on Mark Zuckerberg, not to get too far off topic, on The Atlantic. I don't know if you ever read that.
I don't know. What is that? Is that
The Atlantic? Atlantic Monthly. It's like one of the nation's like oldest magazines.
Now you're making me feel bad.
Well, I don't even know that they publish anymore. It's just an online website now. I mean, they probably still do. Anyone who works for Atlantic, I'm very sorry. I don't know much about it, but it's a good online website. And they had there's a small story about Zuckerberg and how there's this movie coming out now. You know, that's the...
Oh, yeah, it's starring Jesse Eisenberg from Zombieland playing Mark Zuckerberg.
What's it called? Like something social...
Is it just The Social Network?
Something like that.
Whatever, it's the Facebook movie.
Man, we suck. There's three nerds in this room and we don't know second nerd movie they've ever made in Hollywood. The other one was Pirates of Silicon Valley.
What about Hackers?
Well,
21.
Oh, it's a bit of a nerd movie. The Social Network, 2010, is supposed to be out sometime this year.
Yeah, so anyway, they had a little article about that, and they were saying that the person that wrote the article said they think it's going to be a dud because Mark Zuckerberg isn't as interesting as people make him out to be.
He's really not.
No. There was something that they mentioned that he did. Oh, his business card. It says, like, CEO, like, it says, you know, like, you have your name, your number, and then, like, position, and it's like, CEO, bitch.
Like, I think I did see a picture of that on the internet.
Yeah, and I mean, it just, like, the person writing the article was just saying, like, this is how immature this person is, that he has this on his... He has, like, no clue, you know?
He really doesn't. I mean, we've seen him speak, you know, the videos, not in person, but the videos at the D8 conference and other things. And, Jeff, have you ever seen any videos of him interacting with people?
Oh, a few little short clips.
He sucks, doesn't he?
I mean, he's a kid.
That was a leading question. I object.
I'm good at leading questions.
Sorry, Jeff.
I mean, he's a kid who went to Harvard, so that obviously makes him a genius in most people's minds and a business genius.
If you graduate from Harvard, you are automatically able to run a company.
Once you get accepted, you're automatically able to run a company by most people's standards. He came up with a good idea for a website. He might not be the CEO. He had a good idea.
Right. Yeah, I think he's one of those people who should be stick with the ideas and, you know, making things, not running the direct or setting the direction of your company.
Right.
He's made some pretty bad choices so far in that role.
And I guess what I'm getting at is that this is another example of, you know, a lot of possible immaturity and foolishness on their part. They really need to hire some people that know what they're doing.
Do they have PR people?
I don't know.
They'd have to.
I mean, I'm sure they do, but seen anybody named in any articles or anything.
There's two possibilities. They do or they don't. Okay, that would be obvious, right? The other is that they do and they really, really suck.
I was just going to say that. Okay, so we'll stop slamming Facebook now and take a little break. We'd like to hear some words from our friends at Power Thirst.
Do you want to feel so energetic? Try Power Thirst. Energy drinks for people who need gratuitous amounts of energy. With all new flavors like chocolate. Chocolate energy. It's like adding chocolate to an electrical store. Sound the alarm. You're going to be uncomfortably energetic. What's that? You want strawberry? Well, how about rawberry? Made with lightning. Real lightning. Sports. You'll be good at them. It's an energy drink for men. Energy. These aren't your dad's puns. These are energy puns. Turbo puns. Science, energy, electrolytes, turbo lights, power lights, more lights than your body has room for. You'll be so fast, Mother Nature will be like, slow down. And you'll be like, fuck you, and kick her in the face with your energy legs. You'll have so much energy, just running all the time. Power running, power lifting, power sleeping, power dating, power eating, power laughing, power spawning babies. You'll have so many babies. 400 babies. Give chocolate to your babies and they'll be good at sports. Make your babies run abnormally fast. They'll run as fast as Kenyans. People will watch them running and think they're Kenyans. They'll race as fast as Kenyans against actual Kenyans, and it'll be a tie and they'll get deported back to Kenya. Hey, go with the sure thing. Don't gamble on your energy. Snake eyes. Try Power Thirst, the energy drink that will make you sports.
So that was our friends at Power Thirst. Wonderful energy drink. I don't know that. I've never really tried it. It's
tasty.
You guys couldn't hear because I had us all on mute, but we were all literally rolling on the floor laughing.
I'm uncomfortably energetic.
So that started off as just a funny video posted on YouTube, and now it's real. If you go to powerthirst.ca, you can buy in powder form, kind of like the Crystal Light packets, you can buy Power Thirst to mix with water and actually have this energy drink. So that's pretty awesome. But hope you guys enjoyed that as much as we enjoyed that. All right, so moving along. So for as long as I can remember, as long as Napster has been around, which has been, you know, since I was in high school, people have been getting sued for stealing, pirating, however you want to call it, movies and music on the internet. Well, one such guy, Joel Tenenbaum, was recently fined $675,000. This kid is a student at Boston University. He was fined $675,000 by the RIAA. And again, this is the second time. The first time was against Jamie Thomas. You know, she was like this, you know, mother of, you know, a couple kids, whatever. She had no clue what was going on, and she was getting sued by the RIAA, and now this dude's getting sued. But luckily, again, a judge has stepped in and said, this is utterly ridiculous. We are not fining you $675,000. He reduced the sentence by 90%, which makes it, what is that, $65,000 or $67,000? So, yeah, $67,500. But either way, you know, this is a quote from Joel. Obviously, it's better news than it could have been, but it's basically equally unpayable to me. So what do you guys think about this?
I think the fact that the judge reduced the sentence, and I also read some of his decision, it's interesting. He actually said that he thinks that the final amount would be even more than he would have awarded had he been the judge in the original case.
Right. What did he call it? He called it severe, or there were two words that he used, you know, to call what the RIAA said they wanted from him. He basically just said this is ridiculous.
Yeah. And the precedent that the judge used, and I think that this was in the decision, but I read this elsewhere, separate from this specific article on it, that for years, and a lot of times, bar owners get fined by the RIAA, and, I don't know if it's the RIAA, but if it's ASCAP and BMI, which are the organizations that collect royalties for public performance of copyrighted material, specifically recorded material. So they've fined the bars and club owners for years, and the fines are high. They're not cheap to pay the fines, but they're nowhere near as high as what they've been doing to individual persons, to other organizations, like, you know, business to business problems, like where some business misuses a copyright and they get fined or there's a civil suit. they're those decisions are never as high as they were against people. And what the judge is saying, basically, you can't. It's unfair.
You can't do that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's like it's unfair to prosecute somebody with one punishment and not the same punishment for the other. So he's using precedents elsewhere to say that this should only be about $2,000 per infringement.
Yeah, that's. I didn't realize that, and that is utterly ridiculous that they're letting businesses off the hook. Well,
yeah.
They're not letting them off the hook, but compared to what they're making this guy pay, they're letting them off the hook.
Yeah, this is a total scare campaign. I mean, I don't believe in stealing copyrighted material, but that what the RIAA and the MPAA have been doing the last close to 10 years now, well, yeah, probably about 10 years.
Yeah, at least 10 years.
Yeah, because when I started school, my university was so scared about it, they bought Napster accounts for everybody.
Yeah, well,
wow.
Yeah, I was in college before that all went down, because like the Napster was still like alive and well before it was like a pay service,
right?
But it still was like just out of this world, insane what they were doing to people.
Yeah, I mean, when are the RIAA and MPAA going to get it that we're not asking for much? We just want what we want when we want it in the format that we want it in.
Yeah,
if you give us that, we will not steal stuff. Like, it's plain and simple.
Yeah.
You know, people, yeah. It's already been shown, people will pay for stuff. You just have to give it to them the way they want it.
Yeah, I mean, copyrights and patents especially, more so patents, were designed to protect the companies that own the right to the material so that they could promote the item, sell the item, and make money off the item without fear of it being stolen from them. Before they made a monetary gain back on their investment. And that's what's lost today. I mean, the U.S. patent system, the copyright system, all of it's severely broken. The media companies have now used it as a way to basically lock down everything. Because they're, believe it or not, you know, these recordings eventually would enter public domain. But now they've changed, you know, and partially due to the late Sonny Bono, who introduced legislation into the U.S. Congress, extended patent or copyright privileges, like from, you know, 20 years after the death of the author, to like it's like 100 years or more, and now once media corporations buy them up, they basically never expire.
Yeah, this is ridiculous, and the biggest ridiculous thing about this article. Is that you would think, you know, judging from the way that they try to scare people, that the RIAA and MPAA are doing this to give these royalties back to the artist, the person who made the music, you know, put in all the hard work, the producers, the artists, the actors, the extras. That's not where it's going. Where did the RIAA say all of this money from all of these suings are going? Well, they are going to strengthening copyright laws and punishments in the future. They are going towards more scare tactics and more advertisements that you see on TV about not stealing music.
Yeah, basically stepping up anti-piracy activities.
Right. They are not giving this money back to the artist.
It's going to the lawyers.
It's going to the lawyers. It's going to the advertising people. It's going to the PR people. It's going to everybody that it shouldn't go to.
There was a really good article a while ago. I don't even remember where I read it, but it talked about how the music industry really works with the advances that they give. You know, normally if you're an artist, you sign a contract. The music industry or music company, record company, gives you an advance.
You get paid first.
Yeah, the advance is to cover all the upfront cost of making a record, distribution, all this stuff. But a lot of times they're in charge of the distribution, everything else. They just like they give you the money, they charge you back. They take the money back right from you to pay for the distribution. And what you earn on it eventually pays the advance off, and eventually you collect royalties. Some of these artists get stuck in Never Never Land, and they never pay back their advances. It's a loan that hangs over top of them for the rest of their lives, especially if it's something that the music company invests heavily in, thinking that it will be a large hit, and it's not. So the way that industry works is ridiculous.
I totally agree. So move right along. We have another Twitter article here. This one, not so much, you know, bad on Twitter, but, it's something that annoys me a little bit. I know Ryan uses Twitter, probably not as much as I do. I don't know anybody that uses as much as I do. Jeff, do you use Twitter at all? Like, do you actually post to Twitter or just look at things?
I look at things. I have I set up an account basically for some contests at one point in time, but I don't really post to there. I'll post to Facebook every once in a while, but not too much.
Yeah, so the point of this article on a PC Pro's website is that Twitter has gotten so many users, so much bandwidth hogging, I don't know what you want to call it recently, that they are now throttling all third-party clients. They're throttling the API calls. So basically, a client, you know, such as TweetDeck or Echo Phone or whatever Twitter application you would have on your cell phone or on your computer, used to be able to make 350 API calls an hour. And those calls are used for, you know, one call for you posting, one call every time it updates your feed to reread stuff and show you new things. So you can go through those rather quickly. 350 is not a lot of calls. They've reduced it to 175 an hour. And within the last week, they reduced it again to 75 API calls an hour. So, and we made mention of it earlier a little bit, that Twitter is just getting hammered with usage, so many people. And this is one of the things that they're doing to try and stop that. You know, they're throttling third-party apps. You know, does this affect you guys at all? It affects me a little bit whenever I go to post stuff and I keep getting errors that my client's out of API calls. I mean, that sucks for me.
I only use, if I post, I typically only use the SMS, like, you know.
Right, texting to 40404.
Right, which I think they provide that, so there's no limit. And I sure as hell don't post 350 times an hour.
Well, it's not posting. It's any time your client updates, you know, makes a call to get a new feed or a new thread in your feed. I don't know what they're called. Yes, a new tweet.
Yes,
I can't believe I forgot that word.
A Twitter.
Yeah, your client actually blows through those API calls more than you would think.
Well, I take that back then. I mean, I do use a Twitter client on BlackBerry. I don't follow a lot of people. Like, I might follow like maybe 70 people. So, and I only have so many followers too. I don't know if that matters. It would probably just be what you follow.
Yeah, it's the amount of tweeting that your friends, your followers do.
Yeah. And I haven't had any problems with it yet, but I haven't, you know, really, I still don't like check it like all the time either.
Right. Yeah. I have a Twitter client open all day, every day. You know, when I'm at work, I have Twirl open. When I'm home, I have TweetDeck open. And there are a lot of times that I go to send something and I just get errors out of API calls. I mean, maybe I'm the minority. Maybe this only affects me, but I have a feeling that it affects a lot of people who use Twitter a lot more than me. I don't know. It's just a little annoying.
Well, it's not the best situation, but I think Twitter's doing what they can to save their own butt, because they're getting pounded constantly by everything. Anything that happens in the news, people go and look on Twitter for it too nowadays.
Right. If you want to know when an earthquake is happening, just search Twitter for earthquake. You will find out before any news outlet has it.
OMG, ground shake.
Yeah, search Twitter for OMG. You will find out everything about anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do agree. They're trying to keep their service up and running, because I have also gotten an enormous amount of fail whales in the past couple weeks. I try to go search for something and Twitter's like, oh, something's broken. Sorry. Always happens. So moving on from Twitter and getting back into some lawsuit stories. This one has been around for a long time. The Comcast peer-to-peer settlement. Ryan and I, we've talked about this on a couple shows before, about Comcast throttling and killing people's connections and how they're against net neutrality. Well, a settlement for all of those people involved in the class action lawsuit against Comcast for their peer-to-peer blocking has now been reached. And it's not going to be as big as you thought it was going to be. If you're in on that settlement, you can claim your $16. It's kind of funny to me. I mean, this is the way class action settlements work. I mean, if you've ever received something in the mail, you know, anytime a memory goes bad, I get one of those, like, I don't know, once every couple months. There's a new DRAM class action lawsuit. Get in on it if you bought memory between this time and this time. You know, class actions always yield the person affected next to nothing, but it does take a big hit on the company. So did you guys see in the article how much money Comcast was actually fined for this?
I'm seeing something here about a $16 million compensation fund.
Yeah, that's the only number I'm seeing there, too, that makes any sense. So, yeah, Comcast was fined $16 million, and of that, each person in on the lawsuit gets $16.
The lawyers got $3 million.
Of course. The lawyers get $15 million, and you guys get to split up the rest.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I think... I don't want to, you know, talk about this lightly. I think this is great that Comcast has finally gotten fined for doing something bad. I think this is a good first step in companies realizing they can't just go do whatever they want to do without consequences. So,
in some aspects, I can understand what Comcast did. If they were getting pounded and they needed to save the network or create a better service for their users, and what they needed to do was throttle a few people because they were hogs, even if that few people was thousands of people. I understand that, but I wish they would notify those users, like, we have to throttle you back because you're using so much and you're killing our network. We're hoping to upgrade and fix this problem. What they did by just not telling them was completely wrong. I hope that there was other motives behind them, like what I'm thinking, but it was probably just what we're all thinking is, screw the end user.
I kind of agree that they have to... They have their self-interest to keep in mind. You know, they still have to make money and their business. But I still think there's something else going on when somebody can monopolize a network by downloading, downloading stuff all the time. Because, like, think of it this way. When you go to use the network and it's slow, why aren't you able to hog the network? You know, why is this other person miraculously able to hog the network but you're not? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me, because TCP/IP, which is the protocol that drives the internet, has end-to-end congestion control. It should throttle back the other connections. And throttle, you know, it sort of balances
it should even
all.
It out.
Yeah, it should even it out, right? Unless somebody has tampered with the TCP/IP stack. If they do that, immediate terms of service violation, kick them off the network. I think everybody on the internet is able to agree that no one's allowed to modify the stack.
The internet.
Yeah, not for their own purposes. So, and that's exactly what net neutrality is against. Or, you know, is Comcast able to modify their network to suit their needs? Now, if they can't operate and create revenue on that model, then some other company is going to come along and overtake them. So they're doing the exact same thing that somebody must have been doing to be able to hog the network. I think what it really boils down to is that they oversold the bandwidth in certain areas, and they wanted someone to blame.
Right. There were a lot of people thinking that they should be able to download all this stuff because they pay for 8 meg service. They started using 8 megs of service, and Comcast is like, holy crap, we can't give them 8 megs of service.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's plus one for the internet, minus one for Comcast. Just the way I like it.
Sweet.
So, moving right along, it's no secret that Microsoft has a lot of vulnerabilities in their Windows operating system. We hear about them, you know, pretty much every patch Tuesday when we get security advisories and we have to download Windows updates. One group of people have gotten sick of Microsoft taking their time to patch stuff or just plain not patching them for months and months at a time. So the Microsoft group, the Microsoft Security Response Center, that is the group within Microsoft that deals with all of these security advisories. You know, they take them in, they figure out what it is, they work out the patch, they send it into testing and release the patch. So that's the group within Microsoft that does all this. Well, this group of people who are getting sick of their slowness have kind of named themselves with the same acronym, the Microsoft Spurned Researcher Collective. And what they plan to do, and what they have already started doing, is anytime they find a vulnerability in a Microsoft product, they will release it right then and there. It's known as a zero-day vulnerability. And what that means is they don't give Microsoft the chance to look at the vulnerability, fix it, and push out a patch before they release the details. You know, that's normally how this works if you're a good person. You know, you give the company a chance to fix it first. But these guys are like, you know what, Microsoft, you've had 20-some years, and we think you're too slow. So we're going to start releasing these as soon as we find them and force you to fix it right now, or all of your clients, you know, red, all of the world, because most people use Windows, will be affected by this. So what do you guys think about this strategy? Just start releasing 0 days all the time. Ooh, silence.
Ooh, I'm pretty sure that these people are going to find themselves in a world of hurt. Microsoft's going to come after them with everything they got. You have to give them at least a little bit of time. I mean, even if it was a week and you said, you know, every patch Tuesday, these should be fixed, which is more reasonable because these Windows systems that are out there are running some things that are so important in the world. And it's scary to know how easy they are to hack into. If you're even a mediocre hacker, you could hack into most of these systems and take them down.
Yeah, and there's one tool that I won't mention because I don't know the skill level of people listening, but there is one tool that if you get your hands on it, you don't need to know anything. You can just start hacking stuff. You can open the tool, say, oh, I want to use this hack. Click on it, bam, it hacks stuff. So I'm not going to mention the tool name, but those of you out there who know about it know how awesome it is. But I mean, yeah, that's the type of thing. They're going to start releasing these and give people the one-click ability. I mean, they didn't say that they're going to do that, but I see this as where it's going. You know, there's all of these things that these 0 days, you know, being released for, they're going to turn into one-click things that anybody can just hack anything if they want to.
Well, there's a couple problems I have with this article. First of all, and the people, this Microsoft's burned researcher collective. The article says that the thing that initially spawned this was the treatment to researchers that had happened by my, I guess, the researchers that found the hacks and published them previously, whether they waited or not, were treated badly for exposing the hack. So that part, I can understand. Like, they shouldn't be treated badly. The time thing, definitely. That's. I mean, it takes time to figure out what the problem is for sure. So they can't be pissed off about how long it takes to implement a patch. But there, it seems like they're doing this to be vengeful. All right.
I definitely get that sense too.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Here's the thing about being vengeful. Unless you're really good at being vengeful, you're going to get your butt kicked. And they list two things that, like, well, kind of like Justin, they list two things in this article that they're going to release. And there's one, I don't know what the first one is, but it didn't seem all that. It's a flaw in Internet Explorer 8, which that's pretty new. It affects data execution prevention, which is pretty bad. That's not a good thing. And you know, that one could be a problem, but their second in line here is a bug with IIS 5.1 that hasn't been around. Like, I think 6.0 has been the standard for the last, like, long while.
I think what they're saying though, if you click through this article, they give you a link to his blog. He actually said that if you start searching the internet for IIS 5.1, there are still a lot of people running it. And they tend to be, like, big-time people, you know, kind of like places that, you know, government. They don't upgrade until they have a need to upgrade. So, you know, you can think of government entities that are still running IIS 5.1 because they just don't see the need to go to 6 or 7.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is it's a bug on something that's old. It could be easily remedied by just updating to a new version. It's like,
right,
you know what I'm saying? It's not like, ooh, like, you've got me, like, I really, really want to use this software for the rest of my life. You know, it's not something that I don't know. It just seems like they're trying to be vengeful. And if this is all they got, then I'm not real excited about it. And if it's not all they got, if they got some stuff they're keeping in their back pocket, shame on them, because they're not telling Microsoft about it.
Yeah, you know? They mentioned earlier in the article, nothing in detail, but one of them that they've exposed is that kernel level privileges, privilege escalation to get kernel level privileges.
Yeah, wasn't that the one through Internet Explorer 8? Or maybe not.
I think that was a second one. They listed three.
I think that's the help system.
Yeah, that was the Microsoft
help
system.
That was the
one
that spawned it, right?
Right. Yeah, so, I agree. Being vengeful, very stupid, but a part of me wants to kind of agree a little bit with the bad guys here, saying that, you know, you treat us badly and we're going to get mad. You know, you can't expect people to help you if you're going to treat them like crap. You know, you have to thank the people who give these to you, maybe not with money, but at least, you know, recognize them. You have to fix it quickly, because with all of these exploits, they're giving them, if you find a vulnerability, that means that you know how to exploit it, because you've already done it in order to find it. So that means you can tell the company how to break their system. Knowing how to break it, they're, you know, 10 out of 11 steps done with writing the patch to fix it. They have all the hard stuff done. They just need to write the code or modify the code.
It depends. Like, knowing the bug exists is important. Knowing how to repeat, you know,
right, make it repeatable.
The replication of the bug is very important. But fixing a bug can be very time consuming, because if it's an architectural problem,
then you have to change everything.
Yeah, it could be huge. I mean, you know, people wonder why service packs are like, you know, 800 meg, and that's the reason, because if it has to rewrite a lot of architecture, then, you know.
And I kind of think that a little more transparency would solve the problem here. You know, if these guys that found a bug reported it to Microsoft, and Microsoft, you know, had some sort of Bugzilla webpage or something that showed the progress of them working on it, maybe that would solve the problem, that they would see it's not just being stagnant. So, I don't know. I'm on both sides.
That's a lot more how Java works, and maybe that would help. But if these are the same people that keep finding these bugs, I would like to see how come they're not trying to solve the problem by working at Microsoft, because they obviously are very interested in exploiting Windows. And if they're that interested, why can't we somehow... If they're that interested, I'd like to see them trying to be a test engineer at Microsoft.
Right, hire them.
Yeah. Someone from Microsoft should be calling these people, because they're smart.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's the way it goes a lot. You know, Kevin Mitnick, the most famous hacker, you know, he got hired by a company because he was the most famous hacker, and now he does his own thing. But, you know, that's the way it goes. If you have people who are willing to help you and not release 0 days, then you should take their help. So, Microsoft, if you're listening, take their help. Don't make them mad. Because if they do have things in their back pocket, this is not going to be good. So, my favorite application ever, at least that's what people think, because they think I'm an Apple fanboy, is iTunes. And a lot of people have been gaming the iTunes store recently. And what I mean by gaming the store is submitting false or crappy applications or songs or whatever, and getting them to be in the top sellers list. This has happened a lot. You know, this isn't the first time this has happened, but this is one article that I put in here just to bring the point out, because we haven't talked about it before, is that this one dude did it in the iTunes bookstore, where you can, you know, buy books and read them on your iPod or iPad or whatever, and he was able to grab 42 of the top 50 spots in the App Store book category. So this is... You know, this just shows that Apple is not infallible in everything that they do. You know, their App Store is open and vulnerable, just like everybody else's. And, you know, this is just one article showing that, hey, this happens. You know, this one isn't so bad. People's data hasn't been stolen, but their data could be stolen if those 42 things that guy got in the top 50 steal your data.
I think he did steal some data of like 400 people, according to this article.
Right, so that's the people who bought his fake books got their data stolen.
Then they would buy all of his books all of a sudden.
Right. Yeah, so that's the problem. You know, his initial hack, not so bad, didn't steal data. But the effects of his hack, people buying books and him then having their data, very bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think what this demonstrates beyond a shadow of a doubt is that closed systems don't mean better security necessarily. You know, like, I, you know, Microsoft has a closed system, but Apple has touted this closed system as like a, you know, they could maintain security. And I think it's bunk.
Yeah, and this is, you know, all of, especially last week whenever I was bashing on Android and the Google Marketplace, you know, I said that was the one reason why, if you're worried about that, you should buy an iPhone, because all of their, you know, their apps are vetted like that. But apparently that's not the case for the bookstore, and people can do the same amount of harm, you know, with books not being real books, you know, just fake books that happen to steal your data. So yeah, this is something that, you know, I don't know why. Maybe Apple didn't think people were going to put up bogus books, but they really need to start looking at all aspects of their app store, you know, their infrastructure now, and making sure this never happens again. Because now,
I don't think they can ever do that. I mean, they're never going to be able to make sure that it never happens again. It's a wise man once said, they never stole a car until they made one. And then they'll figure out something else to help it make it harder to steal the car. And then they'll figure out something else. Then there was VIN numbers. Then there were license plates. You know, and now VIN numbers are on every part of the car. You know, they're just going to keep finding ways to get through the vulnerabilities of iTunes or any other app store. Hopefully that, I'm hoping that they're learning their lessons and making it more secure every single time. But unfortunately, this isn't the end of it.
Yeah, I definitely think that they will learn a lesson from this. I just think that this is a really big blow to them because, like Ryan said, they've always been the ones touting their closed system as this will not happen. And it happened again. So if you, you know, this just goes back to something I said last week. If you're buying applications for your mobile phone or for anything in general, if you are giving out your credit card number for anything, make sure it's from a reputable place. You know, if you see a book that you want to buy that comes from some no name and there's 50 other of his books in the top category, maybe you should think there's something wrong there. So be careful when you're putting your credit card and private information on the internet, no matter where it's at. So in addition to that private information getting stolen, how many people out there use Skype?
Me.
Ryan raises hand. Jeff says me. So I don't use it that often, so I'm just going to say what this article is about, and I want you guys to talk about this because you use it a heck of a lot more than I do and have a lot more to lose than I do. So basically, Skype's encryption hasn't been broken pretty much forever. You know, the encryption that they use to encrypt their calls and the data going forth, back and forth on their network hasn't been a standard encryption. They've modified a type of encryption, which we now know is the RC4 encryption algorithm, and they've modified that to suit their own needs. But nobody knew that before. But now that people know that, you can actually, you know, decrypt Skype data. So you can decrypt calls, you know, listen in on people's calls. So what does this mean to you guys, you know, as two people who actually use Skype to call people? And what start off by saying what you use it for. Why is this an important part of your life?
I mean, I use it to communicate with my girlfriend, basically. She lives distance away, and we use it on a daily basis, usually to, you know, just know, you know.
Put down your shirt, Jeff.
to talk to each other. I'm not concerned about this because one, I mean, it's a little concerning that, you know, they were able to hack it, but it's not really all that concerning to me because there's two types of, at a minimum, two levels of security that, you know, that I see for information systems. And one are like static information systems, and others are like dynamic information systems. And I think this is a dynamic information system. It's constantly changing. You have to have knowledge of the call, when it's placed. There's timing involved. You have to, you know, if you want to target a specific person, you have to know specific things about that person, and then be able to decrypt the call. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that have to kind of coincide to attack one person.
Yeah, you have to be the NSA wiretapping somebody.
Yeah, or something. Yeah. You know, in the case of a static system, and I mean, I'm making these terms up. Like, I'm not saying this is like...
Well, you're saying Skype is dynamic because it's not constant. You make a call whenever you want to. There's no set schedule.
Right.
Static system would be like Amazon's database holding all of your data.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's also not something that I use to transmit very personal, like... data that could be used against me in another way. It's like, you know,
somebody might be able to blackmail you from something you said, but it's not, you're not transmitting right. credit card information.
Exactly. And even at that, it's just, I'm just not concerned about it. I think it's probably just as easy to listen on to, listen into a cell phone conversation as it is to crack into whatever protocol Skype uses.
I think the person that's cracking it, all they're going to be is chat roulette with a little less porn. I mean, they're just going to see a bunch of people talking to one another. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's no different than hacking cell phones, exactly as you said. It's dynamic. If I'm not online at that point in time, what are you really getting? And if I am online, you're going to see, you know, my baby talking to her grandparents, you right. know?
So do you guys think that any important people use this? Like, do you think Obama uses Skype to talk to his family in Hawaii or wherever he's from that people can't figure out? You know, do you see, like, important things happening over Skype, important conversations where people are transmitting, you know, I don't want to say classified because obviously they're not doing that, but
it's sensitive.
Sensitive data that could harm
I
them.
I mean, maybe, but I would hope, like, if anyone's using it for anything other than just, you know, personal communications, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think there's a privacy there that people want, but I'm a lot less concerned about what I say to my family, friends on Skype than, like, truly personal information that's, like, stored somewhere. But if you're using it for truly personal information or transmitting, you know, sensitive data, I would hope that the network that you're actually running Skype on is a little bit more secure in of itself.
Or doesn't have a connection to the internet. It's a closed yeah. network or something.
Well, I don't know. Does Skype work without a Skype server?
I don't know if you can have your own Skype server or not. I don't know.
Or if it's I don't even know if it's point to point or not.
I have no clue.
I don't know. It might be just SIP based and you can make your own SIP server. I'm not
sure. Yeah, that
on
could
that.
Be.
I don't know.
It could be. But yeah, so if you are using Skype for, you know, really sensitive information, stop it. I mean, there's nothing else you can say about that.
Bad idea in the first place.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so okay, we're going to take a little break right now. You know, we here at the Slongcast, we care about you. We care about our listeners. We want you to, you know, have good mental health. And that is why we have this public service announcement for you today. Are you lonely? Tired of working on your own? Do you hate making decisions? Hold a meeting! You can see people. Show charts. Feel important. Point with a stick. Eat donuts. Impress your colleagues. All on company time. Meetings. The practical alternative to work. Okay, so thank our PSA guy for coming in and doing that for us. You know, that wasn't me. But, you know, he says,
was handsome.
Yeah, he really was. But, yeah, you know, hold a meeting at work. Makes you feel important. And you don't have to do real work then. It's awesome. I love meetings. That was so much sarcasm. Okay, so moving right along, keeping in the security mindset here. This next article, the United States plans a cyber shield for utilities and other companies. So the NSA, which we all know to be the organization that can do anything, and most people think of them as the big wiretapping service. So, you know, they're the encryption experts as far as our government is concerned. If there's anything secret going on, they know about it. And they have now started this new program called Perfect Citizen. And the point of this program is to detect cyber assaults on private companies and government agencies running critical infrastructure, such as power grids, nuclear reactors, things that they say are networkable, but were networkable before the internet came about. So things that were built without worrying about network security because there was no need for it. They weren't connected to anything. But now that everything is, you don't want somebody hacking your nuclear reactor and making a meltdown. So the NSA has decided, hey, these guys aren't doing enough on their own. We're going to start a program where we protect them for them. So what do you guys think about this? Have you heard about Perfect Citizen at any time before reading this article?
Yeah, I've heard about it, and the thing that really upsets me about it is it's not a shield or anything. It's just the NSA looking and trying to do detection of intrusions. I would wish that the government or the Department of Energy, whoever would be in charge of these nuclear power plants and just the regular power plants, you know, the whole grid itself, they would take charge and say, okay, if you're going to be on the network, you have to have these things. These things will protect the grid because we all live off the grid. If the grid goes down, chaos.
And we already found that out. What was it, a couple years ago when something up near Canada got hacked and took out the whole Northeast? Do you guys remember that?
That was about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a hack or if it just was an equipment failure.
Yeah, whatever it was something computer internet related went wrong and took out a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't. Here's the problem that I have with it, and it's if you read the Wall Street Journal article, it's toward the bottom, and it says while the government can't force companies to work with it, it can provide incentives to urge them to cooperate, particularly if the government already buys services from that company. That's coercion, and I don't like that aspect of it. You know, if the government, you know, pays this company money, then the company has an incentive to hand over their data so that the government continues to buy their services, or otherwise they'll shut them off. And now, that's not to say that the government can't set general standards for the, you know, where it puts its money and says, well, if I'm going to invest in this or I'm going to buy this, then I require this type of security for any type of data that's stored there. That they have that right. But I don't know. I'm definitely I don't like the coercion aspect of it. I do like the idea that we're taking a more serious role about security from electronic perspective, because you know, a couple months ago we heard the stories about Google servers being hacked by the Chinese government. Of course, the Chinese government completely disavows any knowledge of it. That they were part of it or whatever, but that right there, in you know, if it were you know 1850, and they had infiltrated a communication system at that time, it could be considered an act of war.
Yeah, somebody would have been shot.
Yeah, I mean it necessarily would have erupted into a war, but it could still be considered an act of war. And it was sort of glossed over as like a nothing. This was a foreign entity attacking an American corporation.
A foreign nation invading our nation.
Yeah.
Whether it's on the internet or not, it's an invasion.
Yeah. Now, I like I said, I don't like the coercion aspect of it on our part. But we're going to need some sort of policies. That, you know, set requirements for certain types of businesses, you know, in terms of security. It may just be that I don't understand why these networks are connected, to be quite honest. Like, I know that a power plant needs to be on a network to access other power plants so that they can coordinate shutting down boilers and nuclear reactors and.
But why does it have an internet connection?
Right. Why is the network not separate? And I mean, it could be done in a physical means separately, like separate hardwired networks. And it could also be done via, you know, virtual means like virtual LANs and that sort of thing. They probably are on a virtual LAN of some sort. And what scares me is that maybe these hackers are really able to just circumvent those routers.
And, right, hack the firewall and then bam, you're in.
Yeah, or hack the virtual LAN system on like a Cisco router. That scares me a bit. I mean, I think this is one of our biggest. There was a piece on 60 Minutes a couple weeks ago about this specific thing. They ran a test and they showed how a group of individuals, it was totally internally United States, hacked into a power plant computer system, not actually attached to a power plant, but it was a replica of one, and they controlled just a diesel generator. And they were able to actually make the diesel generator blow up. like literally blow up.
That's scary.
Yeah, because they took out a coolant system on the generator. The generator, and they shut down sensors, so the generator's computer was unaware that this cooling system went down. It overheated and just basically, you know, just blew the head right off of the generator. So
you're scaring me now.
Yeah, I mean, these could be, depending on the types of safety systems put in place, you know, it's simple things in like a, you know, if you have an emergency power off, if it's a nominally open switch or a normally closed switch, you know, if it requires, you know, like a dead man switch type thing.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, and some of the stuff, you know, we've already mentioned some that the NSA is looking to protecting, you know, electric, nuclear, and air traffic control systems. You know, yeah. We don't think about it, but a lot of those are dirt old, were never meant to be on the internet, and banking, now banks, they all are.
Yeah, banking systems are another one. They're very old.
Yeah, so if you don't think this affects you, it really does, more than you realize. So I think I'm with both. I think we're all in agreement here that it's good that we're taking the initiative and doing this, but the way they're going about it might not be the best.
Yeah, you know, we need some more prevention and less detection.
Yeah. Yeah, detecting is good, but by then it's already happened. We need those requirements up front. You know, if you want your air traffic control system on the internet, you do this, this, and this first.
Yeah.
And maybe they have that. Maybe it's just not working. I don't know. But yeah, we need that. So moving on, this one caught my eye because I like to keep up on the Black Hat and DEF CON conferences that happen every year. And for the past couple years, this one dude has figured out a way to hack an ATM and steal money. And he was going to release, you know, all of his code, everything he did, tell people how he did it at the conference. And the ATM manufacturer stepped in and said, uh-uh, you will cancel your conference event right now. We are not letting you do this. And this happened to him a couple times, and this just happened again. You know, this article was from July 5th. And have any of you guys heard about the ATM hacking at any of the conferences? So yeah, I mean, I think it was Diebold yeah. Was the original manufacturer. I don't know if this is the same manufacturer doing it this time, but either way, ATMs, you know, just like you said, talking about the last article, Ryan, banking systems, very vulnerable. And these ones, they're stupid means. Like the way a lot of people are doing this, if you've ever watched, you know, 60 Minutes or whatever, you've probably seen this. They put a facade over the card reader that matches what the original card reader on an ATM machine looked like, so you don't even know it's there. And it scans your card, it reads your numbers as you scan it, and there is also a tiny, you know, pinhole camera in that reader aimed at the keypad so that it can videotape you entering your security combination. But that's not even what this is talking about. You know, that's the old style hack. This guy actually hacked the software on ATMs. And again, you know, they told him, no, you cannot present this. Because like you said, with the architectural changes, this is just something that if the word got out, this would affect literally every ATM anywhere ever.
Right. And I think that's the key. That it says in there it's about analysis on embedded systems. And I think embedded systems are probably the most vulnerable to an attack in terms of once the attack's been exposed, because it's probably going to require very maybe not expensive, but time-consuming and intrusive upgrades. Like
maybe even unit replacement.
Yeah, they may have to just completely replace the circuit boards in it, you know, with newer hardware. And I don't see any way around it. You know, It's probably good that they know about the hack. It's probably, you know, it's kind of like what I would almost equate this to in some ways is like drug intelligence. There's organizations that track criminal activity, drug activity, and that sort of thing, and they don't publish it to anyone except like law enforcement. And the reason they do that is because enforce better and not disrupt that flow, they need to know that people don't know about it, you know, so they can be assured that these things are going to continue to happen. They can continue to monitor. So I think they need to release this information to the people that need to know it, basically banks. So and that's the type of regulation that might actually help, or how the government could help. They could say, okay, you need to establish a consortium among your industry and meet these requirements to divulge this information in a timely manner, get updates and fixes and that sort of thing. You know, same sort of thing for even like power plants. You know, you have to self-regulate and do these things, and if you don't, you're going to get kicked out of the whatever the regulating body is, and you won't be able to have your power plant anymore or your ATM or whatever. And but to tell everyone, the whole world, about it, and especially a hacker conference, I think that's dangerous.
Yeah, I totally agree. And even since they shut down his talk, you know, at the conferences, I mean, hackers will get the word out. You know, they can just send an email. So I'm worried about that back channel way that, you know, the one dude knows that he's all happy that he figured this out. He's going to tell somebody. Yeah. You know, somebody else is going to know, and then they're going to tell somebody, and they're going to tell somebody. You'd hope you could trust people, but you just don't know. And if something like that does happen, you know, pretty soon you just can't use an ATM anywhere ever again. And I don't want that to happen. ATMs are useful. How do I get my money?
But the way this export is probably working on the embedded system itself, I would assume that they would have to physically bring in a dolly and take the ATM out. It's not really, I don't think, stealing anyone's information. I think what it's going to do is be able to hack into the actual ATM and maybe even tell it, open door, spit out 20s. You know, something right. like that. I think it's just a hole in the embedded system itself. And, like, we're not talking about the one that's attached to the bank. We're talking about the one that's in the bar that has a tiny little LCD screen on it, and you click, and it'll, the only option you have is, to, like, give me 20 or 40 bucks, you know?
Yeah, so bad day for ATMs. ATMs have had lots of bad days, but hopefully this doesn't get out into the public. So one last article on security, and this one I just threw in there because it didn't affect me, but it affected people that I knew. So last week, I believe it was last week, there was the Cisco Live conference. They have it every year. You know, lots of training and lots of conferences about all, you know, the new Cisco products and how to use their current products. And apparently, their database was hacked, and everybody who went there, the possibility of their information being stolen was high. The probability was high because the database that had all of the registrations and everything was hacked. So if you went to Cisco Live, chances are that the people who hacked the database now have your email address, your phone number, perhaps even your credit card that you paid for the event for. So I know a couple people who went to this event, and I told one of them about it. I hope you told everybody else. You know, if you did go to this, watch your credit card statement. You know, you might be getting real, tangible spam mail if people have your address. But, you know, this does happen a lot, so maybe nothing at all will happen from it. But a conference with this many people, and, you know, Cisco Live is basically about Cisco security products. Like, that's what they tout at their conference, and it's just kind of ironic that, you know, their main database got hacked. What do you guys think of that? I mean, there's nothing really to talk about other than it kind of sucks that it happened.
It's the main security conference. There's four networks. There's going to be a million people sitting outside getting into that free Wi-Fi, hacking whatever they can.
Right. Yeah, and that's like the rules whenever – it's the unwritten rules whenever you go to like Black Hat or DEF CON. If you show up with a Wi-Fi device, consider your stuff stolen. Like, you just don't show up with something on the hosted Wi-Fi at one of those conferences. And I think it's the same deal with something like Cisco Live where they're touting security stuff. If you show up and connect to the Cisco Live network, who knows? Maybe your stuff gets stolen. I just thought it was kind of ironic and just wanted to kind of put out a little warning. Hopefully some of you who listen to this, we had like 47 downloads last episode. That is awesome. 47 wow. downloads. I was
pretty
amazed.
Good. Maybe somebody's trying to steal your stuff.
Oh, man.
It was all me. I tried to download an IE.
Oh, that'll do it. Kept crashing. Okay, so we're going to end the show with a couple mobile phone stories. The first one, rather funny. We didn't know the backstory behind this when it first came out, but now we do. So there was this video that came out, and it was just an animated like cartoon video supposedly making fun of Apple fanboys, specifically the people who showed up to buy the iPhone 4 only to find out that they were out. So let me play a little bit of this video just so you can listen to some of it.
Welcome to Phone Mart. How may I help you?
iPhone 4. Where is the iPhone 4? I need an iPhone 4.
Oh, I'm very sorry, but we are currently sold out. However, we did finally get some more HTC Evos in.
What? What is that? Is it an iPhone?
No, it is that 4G phone on Sprint.
If it's not an iPhone, why would I want it?
Well, it's similar to an iPhone, but has a bigger screen.
I don't care.
The internet speeds are around 3 times faster.
I don't care.
It has a higher resolution camera on both the front and the back.
I don't care.
And it doesn't require you to be on Wi-Fi to use video chat.
I don't care.
Its battery is replaceable, as is the memory card.
I don't care.
It is highly customizable, everything from the widgets to the icons, the fonts, and even has video wallpaper.
I don't care.
So I just stopped it there. Basically, it goes on for another 3 minutes of this guy spitting off reasons why the Evo is better than the iPhone, and the dude's like, I don't care, I don't care. And then he starts rattling off stuff like, it prints money. You know, it grants you wishes. The dude's like, I don't care, is it an iPhone?
One of which is that you can have an iPhone.
Right. So, I mean, this is just a cartoon. You know, watching this, you don't know that it's geared toward any store. You know, this is just mimicking a customer talking to a store representative. They never mention the store, or if they do, it's like some generic made-up store. But the story behind this is, apparently it was a Best Buy employee that made this video. And once Best Buy found out about it, they're like, hey, you fired. Or they didn't really fire him. They kind of put him on a probation or suspended or said, you know, leave for a couple days. But luckily, we just found out that the dude is allowed to keep his job. You know, Best Buy said, you can come back to work if you want. The guy doesn't know. If you go to watch that video, you'll see he put a little annotation at the top of the video that says, they offer me my job back. I don't know if I'm going to take it. But what do you guys think about this? Just
well, I mean, I like that. I like that Best Buy is not or offering him his job back or whatever. I mean, because what's happening with Facebook and YouTube and you know, new media is that we have the right to free speech in this country unless we want a job.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah, and if you want a job, you're not allowed to say anything. You know, now I can see not bashing the company that owns you.
And that's what, watching the video link, I think they were more upset about a couple other videos that he has, because he has a bunch.
He did have other ones, yeah.
And the ones that it specifically said Best Buy in, once he got rid of those, the company was happy again.
Okay, well, that's different. I mean, now, that said, I still think there's room for parody and satire. You know, I think those things should still be protected, because if they're libelous or slanderous, that's one thing. If it's satire and parody,
meaning saying false things,
saying false things, you know, and with the intent of malice. There's a specific requirements to mean
that's
libel.
What libel means: false with the intent of malice.
Yeah, and you know, so that it's one thing if that's the case. The other is that, oh, you know, we're just poking some fun at some things that happen. You know, I don't know. I guess it's up to the company. They're a private entity. Well, I mean, they're probably publicly held, but. I guess it just bothers me that people are getting fired for much less worse things than even saying something about their own company.
I'm bothered that Best Buy was even involved in this at all.
Yeah.
At all.
It even goes down to the pierogies and the pirates firing the pierogi that was complaining about the pirates.
Yeah.
Right. My father-in-law deals with a lot of student athletes, and they put a lot of stupid stuff on there. It's also to the point where you have to be cognizant of what you're putting online. You have to think, could this get me in trouble if somebody saw it? Like, if my employer saw me, you know, sleeping at work, and there's a picture of me sleeping at work, maybe I shouldn't put it on Facebook.
Right, but see, there's a difference between that and, like, in the case of the pierogi. Like, okay, so for sleeping at work, you're actually taking away from your company.
It's the satire that you're talking about,
right?
Which is ridiculous. You have to be able to laugh at yourself, too. And,
right.
Yeah.
But even with the pierogi, and that one's a tough one because I guess he's employed by the Pirates organization.
But did he do it on company time? No.
No, he didn't.
So there should be nothing.
But he made fun of the company that he works for.
Right. And it wasn't, I don't know if it was with malice or not. I mean, some people, like, he's probably a Pirates fan.
Right.
And he's probably pissed that the Pirates have had a losing season for the last, whatever it is, 17 years or so. Yeah. Since 1992
or 93.
Yeah. And I mean, he has a point, you know. I mean, I used to be a Pirate fan, and I think we're all kind of pissed that they're that bad. So, I mean, maybe you shouldn't speak, you know, badly about your employer. It's probably inadvisable to begin with.
But you should be able to do it.
Yeah, I still think you should be able to do it.
You should be able to joke about it.
At least joke about it, yeah.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't be able to go online and say how horrible that place is to work for.
I still think you should. As long as you're not doing it on company time, I think you should.
As long as it's not untrue.
Well, I'm not saying say false things.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying just go out there and say really bad things that aren't true just to, you know, hurt somebody, but I think
it's one thing if someone's complaining about their job, if they're like, I hate my job and it sucks and I'm blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's just stupid.
Right. Yeah. There's no room for that. If you hate your job, quit your job.
Yeah,
you know?
Get a new one.
And I think a lot of people, even when they say that, they don't really mean it. It's more like there's specific instances that bother them.
They had a bad day, something
But some
bad
people
happened.
Have dedicated their lives to, you know, like just hating on the people they work for. And that's just, intolerable.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's get out of there and move into some actual mobile phone things. Ryan, did you post this article?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, so do you want to take over?
Well, basically, I saw on Engadget, they had an article where they benchmarked the browser. I guess it's a version of Chrome that's on Android.
I think it's the same engine.
Yeah, it's WebKit-based, just like the iPhone's browser. So they benchmarked the browser in Android 2.2. versus the one in iOS 4.0. And it turns out that in a lot of instances, the one on Froyo on Android 2.2 kicks some butt. There were some places where the iPhone 4 had a strong showing as well. It wasn't. It seemed like the Froyo had the edge. And from what Engadget said, that they thought that Apple's going to have to play a little catch-up.
Yeah, and that's what... This kind of bothers me that, you know, if they are using the same WebKit engine, like, why is there that much of a difference, you know? Like, I know this is the case with, like, desktop Safari, that the real WebKit engine, or I shouldn't say the real, the newest WebKit engine that is, like, totally ACID 3 compliant and is awesome is too new to be in any product. So if you get the newest version of Safari, it's not going to be that new engine. It's not going to be as good. So I'm just wondering, you know, are either of them using the same engine? Are they using different engines? Is it just the fact that Android is so much better at this? I really want somebody to figure it out because I would like to know.
I mean, I don't even know that the WebKit... I mean, I think it's just a framework. I mean, WebKit, right?
It's like the engine.
Well, right, but I mean, it's not... You can't just get WebKit and it's a browser. Like you have to.
Oh, right. You need like a front end and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it could be that the front end aspects of this are lighter, which allow the threads that are doing the background engine processing in Froyo to, you know, do it more speedily. It could just be a simple fact that the TCP/IP stack is faster. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and the article doesn't really say. You know, it did give benchmarks, but nobody really like decompiled anything and found out what the deal was. But either way, I think we can both say that Jeff, it's better than the browser on your BlackBerry.
My BlackBerry Storm works great.
You guys can't see the smile on his face now, but there's a big one. So yeah, this article clearly shows that at least on the Nexus One, the web browser for Android Froyo 2.2 is much faster than the iPhone 4. I think you could say it pretty much wins. Like, there were more aspects on Froyo that were faster than there were on the iPhone.
Right. I mean, it wasn't... I just say it wasn't a total annihilation.
Right. Like,
there was a
right.
couple things. But the one thing that was interesting is Froyo supports Flash.
I was just going to bring that up.
I think the other thing that was interesting was the iPhone was the first to show up, and Froyo was the first to finish on almost all of them.
Yeah, there was some interesting things there. I mean, that probably lends itself to the... Like I was saying before, that there's something in the front end that's different.
Right. Yeah. Like, it's almost like the iPhone might push the first half faster.
Yeah.
But why Froyo works the whole way constantly, maybe.
Yeah. Well, from what I've seen with Safari, and I don't, is that what they call it on the phone?
Yeah, too? Mobile Safari.
Yeah. Like just using it on my desktop and seeing demos of it and hearing about it, you know, being, oh, it's so fast, it's so fast. It's really good at like getting you like 80 to 85% of the page fast. And then the rest of the load time still takes a bit of energy, you know, just like it would another browser.
Right.
And I think just seeing, I mean, this is just this, the you know, me being like a CS guy and what's going on in the background, I'm wondering if they're doing like a lot of heavy prediction of like, they see the tags and, you know, the opening tags for everything. And they're like, oh, I know what they're doing. They're building a table and, oh, they're building this tag and, oh, they're going to, this is what the web page. So that I think my guess is that the Safari engine's predicting what the web page is going to be like based on some rules. And then just confirms it once the rest of the page loads.
I think it kind of goes with abstraction is what they're doing. From what I can tell, is what I think it's doing is it's going, okay, here's a table, here's a table, here's a table. It's going to lay out like this. Then we're going to put these things in this table, and these things in this table, and these things in this table, to where it just keeps refining the quality of the page.
I think you're both talking about pretty much, you know, kind of the same thing.
Yeah, but instead of predicting it, it just kind of goes up to a very high level and just keeps refining.
Drilling down.
Yeah, because you can kind of see that happen. I think all web browsers actually do this, because if you watch pages load that have multiple tables or multiple columns, you can see the page, you know, as soon as it shows up, looks like crap. And then, you know, in 10 milliseconds, oh, you see a column appear. Then in another 10 milliseconds, oh, there's a second column. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, here's the table and it's filled in. So, yeah, I think that makes sense.
It might also be really heavily threaded, like where once it sees a table, all the table elements get spawned in their own thread, and that does a load separately so they can get, I don't know. It's just interesting how the browsers attack the problem of loading a page. And I will give the credit to Apple that Safari seems to give you a very clear picture quickly of what the page is about and let you interact with it before it's finished loading.
Right. Yeah, and I'll just get in one little jab there that, you know, WebKit is Apple's product and every other browser is starting to use it now.
That's not their product.
Yeah.
Well, they use
that's Apple.
They didn't start it.
Who started it?
It was an open source project.
Was it?
Yeah.
As far as I knew, that was like Apple's baby.
They majorly forked it at one point. They took what was there.
Okay,
and
so they didn't start it, but they made it big.
Yeah. Well, they definitely, and I think, I'm not sure that the original WebKit project is even in consortium with Apple anymore in terms of like agreeing what the base WebKit is anymore.
Right.
It's what Chrome uses too, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on. This is another Google story as far as the Google Marketplace is concerned. And, you know, last week I caught some flack for bashing Google Marketplace and how Google doesn't take care of it at all. You can, you know, anybody can put anything malicious in there. And I kind of had to throw this article in there because it at least a little bit confirms what I said. If anybody knows DVD John, John Leck Johansson, he was the guy who figured out how to crack CSS, which is the encryption on DVDs. He is the guy you need to thank that you can rip a DVD to your computer and watch it, you know, on your computer or on your iPod or on any other device. He's the guy who first broke that encryption. And he came out with an article on his site that kind of complains a little bit about the Android marketplace. His biggest complaint being just what I talked about last week, except he says it a little bit more nicely, that Google doesn't do enough curation of its marketplace. You know, with Apple, you have, you know, they're very heavy-handed in what they allow in there and how it's formatted, how it's presented, whereas Google, anybody can put anything in there. And he thinks that's going down the wrong path, that Google needs to take a bigger part in the Google marketplace, get out the bad stuff before it even get, or just not let in the bad stuff, not even get it out. They shouldn't let it in the first place. So what do you guys think about DVD John's comments about the Google marketplace or your own about Google marketplace?
I mean, I haven't really used it all that much. I've purchased a few apps on friends, you know, or used it on a friend's phone. Not purchased apps, but I mean, the way I look at it is, you could look at it two ways. Yeah, maybe they don't do enough curation. They don't really call out the bad stuff and promote the good stuff and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, it's like, hey, they're hands off. They're just letting the market be as it may. Like, to me, this would almost be the equivalent of eBay, you know, picking which things it wants to be on the top of its list. And what eBay does is just lets people pay to promote their things. Now, in some ways, I think eBay's like, it's crappy now because of that. But I don't know. I kind of like the hands-off approach in some ways.
See, I kind of think this is, using your eBay example, I think that this is eBay not taking down people who are selling iPhone boxes instead of a box with an iPhone in it. You know, that's kind of what I see this as Google doing. Mm. You can sell an iPhone box, making people think it's an iPhone, but they're not going to take it down. It's just there, and it's going to trick you, and you spend $100, and you get a cardboard box.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you trick a few people, but I still think that in the end, if there's a rating system, that's going to trump all. You know, in the BlackBerry app world, I don't know how much their curation goes on there, but, you know, people just you Google around and you find out what are the good apps, and people just kind of say, hey, this is what you want to get. Like, I wanted a weather app, and people are like, oh, the only good one is this one, and, you know, and that's what I bought, and I like it. So I don't know.
Yeah. Jeff, you look like you had something to say.
I think the whole Android and iPhone war is turning into what we were talking about earlier. It's a repeat of the history of Microsoft and Windows, except Android's the player this time in the mobile phone market. Windows was always a very open system where you could buy anything and put anything on there. I mean, who doesn't remember back in the day where you could go buy a clip art CD for like $5 at Staples or whatever, you know, and it was just full of all kinds of junk. And I think the same thing is going to happen with the Android market. You're going to be able to buy anything. You're going to have a million different platforms to put it on, which is what some people want. And you're going to have the Apple where this is what we have. If you don't like it, go buy an Android.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. I see this. I agree with Ryan in what you were saying that, you know, if you want a weather app, Google it, find the best one, install it. But my main point, and it's always been my main point, that works for us tech-savvy people. You know, if our parents or somebody get this phone, they're not going to know to Google and find out the ratings. They're going to go to the marketplace. They're going to search for weather. And if somebody happened to game the system and get some weather app that shows up, they're just going to pick the first one, install it, and then bam, they lose their personal information. They lose $5 on the app. Something happens. You know, I'm not worried about us. You know, we're going to be fine. I'm worried about the 90% of the population who aren't us and who just want a phone to have a phone, and they're going to go download stuff and be taken advantage of.
Well, I mean, I understand that, but when you walk the streets in New York City and there's a guy selling watches, you know, he opens his coat, whips out one of those portable tables and puts down his wares. It's like, are you going to buy the watches, or are you going to haggle with them to get it for the price you want? I mean, you can't be a blind consumer in these things.
I agree, but for some reason, that's not the way it happens.
The internet is very easy to be a blind consumer because it's hard to tell who's reputable and who's not.
I don't know.
The only thing that you can hope is that there's a decent rating system where the users can see that, oh, this one's got 4 stars.
A prominent rating system.
Let me look at the reviews. Oh, you know, this person got their information stolen. But you're still not going to be able to stop the average dumb Joe from just Googling weather, picking an app, and taking it.
Yeah, like your example, in the real world, yes, we all know because we've all grown up in the real world, don't buy something from the watch guy on the street. But as far as people who haven't grown up with the internet, don't understand the risks, they just want to get on, check their email, and now that they know, oh, there's a phone that I can get my email on, awesome, I'm going to buy that phone. You know, those are the people who... they can't equate the watch seller on the street with the illegitimate app seller in the Google marketplace. They don't know the telltale signs of who's good and who's bad.
Well, I mean, life's an IQ test. That's how it works. I mean, if we game the system for the uninformed, they will never become informed. You know, it will always have to cater to this. Like, if, you know, I mean, I guess in some instances, street peddlers really aren't allowed to be out there, and, you know, a cop might shoo them away. But, it's the same's true of any store you walk into. Anything you buy, buying a car, buying a washing machine, you know, you have to do your homework. And if you don't, well,
So buyer beware.
Yeah, buyer beware. I still think buyer beware. We have to, you know, there has to be a driving force for education in that area. And I think if people don't learn to use the internet as part of their lives, they're not going to make it.
No, I totally agree. I know for a fact certain people who stay away from the internet and using it for those things, and, you know, they're the people who are going to get hit.
Right. Well, I mean, not to belabor it, but it's like, I know people, I mean, not anyone personally, but, you know, you hear those crazy people, like, they don't like banks, and they keep all their money in, like, a safe.
Tinfoil people.
Yeah, like, under their mattress, they keep all their money in their mattress. It's like, well, that's all well and good, you know, like, not investing your money until the dollar is worth, you know, one-fifth of what it was 4 years ago, and now your money's worthless. So, I mean, your house burns down, and all your money's gone. You know, there's a part of knowing that you put your money into a bank that it's insured and stuff. So I think if you choose to be a recluse and not participate, you're going to be equally screwed. You have to learn it, you know, and if you choose not to learn, then in my opinion, don't deserve to do as well as somebody that did take the time to learn.
I totally agree with you. I think I can speak for all of us when we say, you know, buyer beware, you need to learn. You know, the internet is here to stay. Don't stay away from it. Don't pretend, this internet thing. You know, you need to figure it out. So, last article. Oh, go ahead.
I say, or pay somebody to figure it out for you.
Right. There are people out there who, you know, give their services out for a nominal fee. You know, have them teach you.
I guess that's what Apple does.
It kind of is.
It's funny how we come full circle.
Really? Speaking of Apple, last article of the day. So, we talked about the iPhone antenna problems. And, you know, any other problem that happens whenever an iPhone launches. But there seems to be one that is happening to a lot of people, and it's a glitchy proximity sensor. So what this is, for those of you with any sort of smartphone, your phone has a proximity sensor where when you're holding it in your hand, the screen is on, and you can press the buttons or do whatever. When you get it close to your face, the screen goes off so that your face doesn't start pressing buttons. So that's what the proximity sensor does. And apparently, on the iPhone 4, a lot of people are having trouble where the sensor doesn't detect your face, and they are randomly making calls, and, you know, they're talking to somebody, and you get the beep, beep, beep. You know, people just pressing buttons with their cheek. So this is another bad hit for Apple that, you know, they had the antenna problem. Now they have a proximity sensor problem. Personally, I haven't found either of these to be a problem with mine, so apparently it's not affecting everybody, but it's affecting enough people to spawn an article in PC World. So what do you guys think about this? You know, funny?
It's funny. I mean, here's the danger for Apple. And for the US in part. Apple's our leading tech company right now. That, you know, in terms of market capitalization, they're a big company. People invest in Apple. They're going to make money by Apple. Our retirement's account are going to live and die by Apple in some instances. Apple has set themselves on a pedestal where they are perfect. They have an image of being perfect. And every time by doing that, when they're not, their credibility goes down even more than it would. Like, people expect this stuff from HP and Dell and the other hardware manufacturers, but they don't expect it from Apple. So I think that's why this is going to continue to erode at Apple and eat at their value, because there's a perception that's why they're so valuable, is a perception that
it's the same thing that's happening to Toyota right now.
Yeah, it's very, very good point. I mean, because Toyota has always had a perception of reliability, of, you know, worthy or not, they've had that perception, and when something like that happens with their gas pedal, it erodes consumer confidence, and they just become one of the bunch then, you know. So, and they'll have to find ways to separate themselves, you know, to continue to be profitable. And that's
my worry for Apple is that you know, I mean, it's probably not even that big of a problem, but when you sell perfection, which is a dangerous thing to sell or to claim about yourself, I think that's where the problem is.
Yeah, this definitely shows that they haven't lived up to the bar that people have set for them.
I don't think they've ever sold perfection. I think people have sold them as perfection. I think they've always sold, we have the best product that can do what you want to do. We have the best computer that can do what you want to do. We have the best phone that can do what you want to do. We have the best thing in between the phone and computer that can do what you want to do. But selling perfection, I'm not sold on that. I think they have always sold the best product that they could put out there. Every product that I think that they've put out there have always had their glitches, and they've always done the best to fix those glitches. So I'm hoping that this is just another glitch.
Well, I mean, I don't know. On the perfection thing, I've always been very... I thought the Apple commercials with John...
I'm a PC.
Yeah, I'm a
Mac.
Yeah, those commercials.
John Hodgman.
John Hodgman. Thank you. Those commercials are evidence that Apple has a higher standard, or did at one time. They've since dropped those commercials. Maybe they finally realized that they're not perfect. There's a reason there's a website called fixmymac.com, you know, or whatever the heck it is. They're not perfect. But that said, I think they at least at one time held a perception.
I think they exuded perfection, but they never stated it.
Right.
You know, like they always said, we are the best.
Yeah.
But none of their commercials ever said we are perfect. So it was kind of one of those things where all of their advertising made us think they're perfect. So everybody thought they're perfect. And now we expect it.
Right. There's just some modesty that has to be that they need to show, I think. And that they haven't shown the modesty, I guess.
Right. Maybe that's the new round of advertising since the I'm a PC ads are gone away.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll see that soon. Who knows? Maybe that'll be the advertising when the iPhone comes to Verizon.
You know, I wasn't... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm waiting for that iPhone on Verizon.
Not me. I'm very excited about the Droid X. I think...
Really?
Yeah. I really like that larger form factor. I have big hands. I've been saying for years, I think that these small, tiny phones are stupid. I want a big phone. I want, you know, and like in some ways, I don't see myself carrying around an iPad, but I do see myself carrying around maybe a slightly larger screen
I would never see myself carrying around an iPad.
Right.
But yeah, when I think of the Droid X, I think of like heavy multimedia users. I mean, you bring up a good point. I never thought of that before, that people with big hands, that's just a better phone because it fits better.
Yeah.
But that's what an iPhone user is too, though, is a heavy multimedia user.
Yeah. Except I think that the Droid X could convert iPhone people to Android devices because it has the bigger screen, it has the HDMI output.
You're going to be able to cameras. See the web page.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, because that's, you know, that's the same thing with that Retina display that they promoted.
Have you actually seen it in person?
No, I actually haven't.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
Yeah, of course.
I'm bringing out my phone right now.
I'm amazed when I'm across the table.
Like, put your eyes up against that as close as you can without getting blurry. You cannot distinguish pixels.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It looks great and everything, but I guess what I was getting
it's
at
perfect.
Before, what I was getting at before is that the oh, I'm just so amazed by the screen. No, I'm kidding. What I'm getting at before is that the sometimes it's not the pixel density that's so important as the size of the screen itself. Like, you know, like if you're better than what your retina can see, you're wasting money, basically. You're wasting money on that technology.
Make the screen bigger so we can read the page.
Right. I mean, and that's part of the problem is like the pages are just too small. And we're talking about going from like 3.7 to 4.3 inches. It's not a huge deal.
Right.
But I'm just excited about the Droid X. I think that's the one that may switch me off of my BlackBerry. I like the other Droid.
The Incredible?
Yeah, but the battery life is pretty rough with that.
I don't know that I want to trust any reviews on that. I mean, the reviews of the iPhone's battery, every version has said that it sucked. And I don't have a problem. I charge my phone. Well, now I charge my phone like every 4 days. The iPhone 4 is double the battery life of my 3GS. But it used to be that I would charge my phone every 2 days. You know, I would get one full day, and then the next day when I come home from work, I'm charging it.
That's what I charge my Storm, is about every 2 days.
Yeah, so I mean, all these people reviewing about battery life, I don't know that I want to believe that about any phone.
Yeah.
Just because I don't know.
My battery will go 2 days, but I never let it.
Right.
I just charge it, because lithium ions, a cycle is...
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It can be, if it's a half cycle, you know, if you only charge it from 50 to 100, it's a half cycle.
Yeah.
So it doesn't count as a charge. So I just charge it every night, because it's easy. You just stick it, plug it in, it goes into bedtime mode, and it wakes me up in the morning, because it's an alarm. But the, you know, the battery life on the Droid on that Incredible, though, from what I've seen, is that it's like, they're not even getting a day out of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Now... There could be reasons for that. It could be, you can maybe optimize some things, but
I think Bluetooth's on.
And that's what makes me worry about the Droid X, is that, you know, it being a multimedia powerhouse, bigger screen, HDMI connection, you know, is that going to drain the battery more than normal phones?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see. I mean, yeah. I just like the idea of it. I like the bigger screen.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I think it looks like a beautiful phone.
Yeah, it's slick looking too, so... You know, I just one other thing about the iPhone. I wasn't here last week to talk about the antenna flaw in some more detail.
Right.
There was an article I saw today was on Engadget that Consumer Reports rated it a skip. They said skip the iPhone if you're buying a phone.
See, I saw that too, and I don't believe it. I don't have problems.
Yeah, I don't. They tested 3 or 4 devices, and Engadget tested a couple as well. And they were able to repeat the results, I guess.
Well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I can repeat it.
Yeah.
If I hold the phone like a douche, I can repeat it.
Right.
But, you know, I'm getting out my phone now for those of you who can't see, but this is how I hold a phone when I make a call, the Vulcan Death Grip. You know, you have to hold a phone in the palm of your hand, and then your fingers cover the screen, and it's really awkward to hold. If you hold the phone like this, this is the only way you can repeat that.
Well, I don't know. Like, I hold my phone like this. So I think I would probably be in that
Yeah, like I
range.
Mean, I've always held every iPhone that I've had. It's either this or it's like the knuckle grip, depending on how I pick it out of my pocket.
Yeah, see, I don't hold a phone like that, and you look like an alien holding it that way.
I think, like a Vulcan.
Yeah, I think you talked to Steve Jobs, and he advised you on how to hold it.
Yeah, I mean,
yes, I will hold it that way, Steve.
I mean, if I hold my phone and I cover up that little thing like this, I can make it happen.
Let me see your phone for a second. Oh shit! I dropped it. No.
Ugh.
I would hold it, like, if I pulled it out of my pocket, I would probably hold it like this. Or, in this hand, like this. And in both cases, no one can see this. In both cases, I'm covering that port with my hand.
So basically fingers from on the bottom 50% of the device.
Yeah, because I want the part near my ear to be, like, you know, I usually actually use my hand to cup my voice.
See, that's the only time that I could ever make that problem happen is when, like, there's wind and I'm doing the cupping motion to keep the wind out of the microphone.
I hold a phone like that all the time.
Yeah, I never do, so I never have that problem.
I think the same thing's going to happen with the Wii. You know, they're going to release a little skin for it that they're going to put over top of it and be like, hey, look, problem's fixed.
Yeah, they already did release it. They're just not giving it away to people yet.
They're going to give them away. Yeah. They're going to have to. It's a problem.
You know, the one thing I will say about the new interface, they have these new, like, groups you can, like, throw the icons.
The folders.
Yeah, they're terrible looking. Like, I mean, I like that you can do it, but they look goofy.
Yeah, they don't look right.
And, you know, looking at Android, there's some things about Android that I like about the home screen and how you can customize what's on there, especially the HTC Sense UI.
That's a great-looking UI.
You know, it's really nice. Now, there's some overhead and stuff, but... This icon-based UI on the phone, which is very, like, Windows desktop-esque, is getting a little tired. I don't know if anyone's seen the Windows 7 interface, or Windows Phone 7, but it's, like, radical departure.
Is that, like the Zune style?
No. Well, it has a Zune media player in it. But the way they've taken a completely different, view on the interface of the phone, which, to me... is impressive just for the fact that it diverts from the desktop interface that really is what the iPhone is emulating.
Right. They stick with icons because people know it.
Yeah, right. It's familiar.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in what Microsoft's doing because, like, the ribbon, they spent a lot of money researching that ribbon and finding out that it was more efficient to use it. And over time, I've learned to like it. I actually wish more of the interface was ribbonized. because there's some things you still can't get to. You know, so it's kind of fractured right now.
Right, those things you can get to, it's literally two clicks and you can get to everything.
Yeah, but then the things you can't, they're kind of buried.
They're hard, yeah.
Right, but they're less used. Anyway, my point is that I'm really impressed with Microsoft's leadership in this area with like UI design. Because the Windows Phone 7 interface is like nothing I've ever seen. It uses these tiles, and so that you could say the tiles are kind of like
the tiles. Okay.
Yeah, they're kind of like icons, but the whole when you enter into a tile, the whole thing is based on this, like they've already drawn them out, like they're like a panoramic view of all the things that you can get to, and then your phone is like a window on that panorama, like where you are in it. So it's like a skinnable type thing. It looks really cool.
Sorry, I just had to cough there.
Yeah,
big cough. Okay, so any last thoughts, Jeff, on any of this? No.
No, I'm really hoping that BlackBerry is going to come out with something to compete. I really do like my Storm. I don't think it's a horrible phone like the rest of the world says. I think it's a very suitable phone. I'm hoping that they can come out with a little bit better. A little bit better interface. It doesn't need to be a ton better, and a little bit better phone, and they could compete again. I'm worried that BlackBerry's going to lose its number one position.
It's an interesting point about losing market share. There was a stat that came out. They had a market share summary of all the different technologies. The only phone OS to gain market share last quarter is Android. Everyone else lost market share.
That is interesting. Did they give any reasons why, speculations?
I really just think it's because they're pushing Android so hard right now. Yeah. I mean, you know,
so much advertising.
Yeah, every phone. Well, I haven't seen any ads on TV, but every phone has Android has some Android OS on it.
Yeah, pretty much if you get a Verizon phone, you're getting Android whether you realize it or not.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Hopefully you're right. You know, RIM does come out with something, because if they don't, you know, we mentioned this a couple weeks ago, they might go under if they don't come out with something soon.
Well, 6.0 is on the way, BlackBerry OS 6.0, and that new Bold 9800, I think it's called, which is the QWERTY slider, is supposed to be out on AT&T. So, I mean, I think they got some stuff up their sleeve.
Let's hope. All right, so that is it for this edition of the Slongcast. As usual, you can tag stories if you want us to talk about them on Delicious. So for next episode, tag it as Slongcast010 for episode 10. And when you do that, we'll get them and we'll talk about the stories on the show. I can be found on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. As usual, Ryan can be found on Facebook and Twitter, username Ryan Lancey. And Jeff, where can people find you if they want to find you on the internet?
You can find me on Facebook if you're a friend of mine.
So if you don't know Jeff, you're not going to know him. All right, guys. So this was a long one. I hope you got to the end. Have a good night.